So my talk is about the instability of the concept of public order, particularly as a replacement for the term common good, and especially in regards to matters of religion. And in order to focus the inquiry, I have in mind the much-discussed conclusion of paragraph 2 of the Second Vatican Council's Declaration on Religious Freedom, Dignitatis Humanae. So that's what the talk will be about. That paragraph concludes with a statement: the right to religious freedom has its foundation not in the subjective disposition of the person, but in his very nature. In consequence, the right to this immunity continues to exist, even in those who do not live up to their obligation of seeking the truth and adhering to it, and the exercise of this right is not to be impeded, provided that just public order be observed, or justus ordo publicus. Here, public order is introduced as a limiting concept for civil intervention in religious matters. The exercise of the right to religious freedom is not to be impeded, provided that just public order be observed. The exercise of that right may be restricted only when its exercise poses a threat to public order. Based on the official, although not magisterial, relationes at the council, restriction of the state's intervention to the end of preserving just public order implies the civil power's pursuit of temporal ends only. As Thomas Pink put it in a 2015 paper explaining the idea, this just public order exception, he said, must have to do with religious activity that is damaging goods that are other than religion itself, and that, by contrast to religion, do not fall under the authority of the state. Now, it is famously on this point that Dignitatis Humanae has been said to mark a change in the Catholic Church's traditional emphasis on the state's pursuit of the common good, understood to include both a temporal and a spiritual end, and therefore the possibility of restricting activity that violates just public order, as well as restricting activity that would obstruct the state's orientation toward a spiritual end as well. Some attempts to reconcile the teaching of Dignitatis Humanae with the traditional endorsement of civil cooperation with the Church depend, as Tom Pink points out, on a broad interpretation of just public order that would include such ends, particularly in view of the different valence of theological disagreement in a generally liberal as opposed to generally pre-liberal world. For example, one could make the argument that in a society dominated, and this is the argument that he rejects, someone could make the argument that in a society dominated by a single sect and with low tolerance of other sects, the preservation of just public order might justify a larger set of interventions to preserve the favorable status of the dominant sect. So in a pre-liberal era, the argument goes, perhaps even just public order could justify intervention in favor of a particular sect. Such an argument would work by attempting to explain pre-liberal church-state cooperation on the basis of the public order concept. As Pink shows, however, the definition of just public order that was presented to the council was a narrow and not a broad one. And a relatio of September 1965 adopted the following meaning of just public order, quoting from the canonist Arthur Vermeersch: those laws have to do with public order that do not only have the public or the common good for their end, which all law does, but have it as their immediate object. These are laws which, unless kept by everyone situated in a territory, that community will suffer damage. Laws that aim at the sanctification of the faithful, Vermeersch concludes, are not of this class. As is well known, Pink uses a distinction between the civil order and the order of religion to show that Dignitatis Humanae permits the state to impede the exercise of the right to religious freedom only with regard to the ends of the civil order. In the pre-liberal order, the state restricted this right and took other actions with regard to the order of religion, not on the basis of an understanding of just public order that included spiritual ends, but upon being enjoined by the Church with that task. For example, as Pink notes, in Session 25 of the Council of Trent, the Council Fathers, in their words, quote, thought it right to warn secular princes, too, of their responsibility, trusting that they, as Catholics whom God has wished to be protectors of the holy faith and of the Church, will not merely allow a restoration of the Church's law, but will also recall their subjects to do reverence toward the clergy, both parish priests and those in higher ranks. That's the Council of Trent. Pink's well-known exposition of the traditional teaching and reconciliation of it with the teaching of Dignitatis Humanae emphasizes the role of baptism in establishing the baptized as members of the church subject to the church's jurisdiction. The classical teaching that secular princes and the civil power generally have an obligation to protect the church, to promote the faith, and to restrict efforts to undermine it stems from their membership in the church. This is Pink's argument. From the church's sole possession of the spiritual power, and from the church's requiring in the classical model her members in positions of civil authority to cooperate with the church for spiritual ends. As Pink summarizes his view, it's clear in Dignitatis Humanae that something very new has happened. The church is no longer choosing to address the state as her religiously coercive agent, he says, inviting it to act in defense of the Catholic truth. She is now addressing it as detached from such a role, as a potestas of the civil order only. But at the same time, and even in so doing, the doctrine that the church has a right to treat the state as her agent, at least under certain conditions, is still being carefully observed. This argument has gotten a lot of attention in recent years as a way of reconciling the new teaching, emphasizing religious liberty with the old. Although Dignitatis Humanae does not explicitly withdraw a past demand that the civil power cooperate with the spiritual power in spiritual matters, it doesn't say, there's no portion of Dignitatis Humanae that says, you know, we hereby withdraw from the state this cooperative power. It nevertheless just, you could say instead that it describes and treats the civil power in abstraction from its past cooperation with the spiritual one. Some of the concordats between the Holy See and states were updated after the Council to reflect this. The 1984 agreement between Italy and the Holy See amended the 1929 Lateran Concordat, and it begins in a way that fits this well and will serve some purposes of the argument in a few minutes. It begins, "The Italian Republic and the Holy See reaffirm that the state and the Catholic Church are, each in its own order, independent and sovereign, and commit themselves to the full respect of this principle in their mutual relations and to reciprocal collaboration for the promotion of man and the common good of the country," end quote. Read in this light, or read in light of, you know, looking at Dignitatis Humanae again in light of this, the beginning of that concordat, Dignitatis Humanae could be understood as a recognition that the civil power and the spiritual power, each being in its own order, independent and sovereign, would not mix in the matter of spiritual ends. The civil power would allow the spiritual power to operate, and the spiritual power would not demand that the civil power cooperate in the matter of spiritual ends. As Article 2 goes on of the 1984 agreement between Italy and the Holy See, or the Italian Republic and the Holy See, states, "The Italian Republic shall recognize the full freedom of the Church to develop its pastoral, educational, and charitable mission of evangelization and sanctification. In particular, the Church shall be assured the freedom of organization, of public exercise of worship, of exercise of its magisterium and spiritual ministry, as well as of exercise of jurisdiction in ecclesiastical matters." In other words, the policy of the Church after Dignitatis Humanae could not simply be described, for example, by traditionalist critics, as a withdrawal from the civil power of its cooperation in matters pertaining to the spiritual power, although Dignitatis Humanae does take this line. It must also be placed in the context of clarifying the Church's proper jurisdiction after attempts throughout the 19th and 20th centuries to strip it of its liberty and jurisdiction, and indeed, of course, all of its territory. The Concordat, then, was an essential supplement to Dignitatis Humanae in clarifying that relationship. Now, the distinction of powers into civil and spiritual is not present in classical accounts, I mean, the accounts of ancient political philosophy. Aristotle's Politics, for example, describes a ruling aristocracy whose members are young, when they are young, fight, when they are in middle age, govern, and when they are old, pray. The priestly class would simply be distinguished by age from the other classes, but would not constitute a separate or independent jurisdiction. The distinction between the civil or temporal power and the spiritual power, then, is a consequence of the advent of the church and of its particular claims. The eventual goal of that distinction, as is obvious in an account such as that of Pope Gelasius, was to place the civil power in cooperation with the church, including for the obtaining of spiritual ends. For a policy in which the church refrains from asking the civil power to cooperate with the spiritual ends of the church, the new policy then, there are two questions. First, whether the spiritual power, that is, the church, can successfully restrain itself from its past demand, demanding cooperation from the civil power in spiritual matters. And the second question is whether, which is what my talk will, the rest will focus on, is whether the civil power can restrain itself from acting under color of spiritual jurisdiction to treat matters of the soul. On the first point, the record is clear. Not only did the church refrain from demanding the cooperation of the civil power in spiritual matters, but in the post-Vatican II era, it actively divested itself of a privileged status in countries where it had previously enjoyed it. Spain modified its charter of July 13, 1945, on June 28, 1967. The 1945 charter had provided, quote, no authorization for external ceremonies or manifestations other than those of the Catholic religion. While, in the words of the 1967 modification, quote, the state guarantees the protection of religious liberty, which shall be guaranteed by an effective juridical provision which will safeguard morals and public order. To that modification was attached a preface explaining that the Spanish Charter was being modified in accordance with Dignitatis Humanae, and obviously it rests also on the Ordo Publicus framework. Evaluating the success of the Ordo Publicus framework, however, requires considering not only whether the Church can drop its requests of Catholic states, as it did, but whether the civil power can agree to self-restriction in the matter of religion on the same basis, on the basis of the public order, or on some other base, or on some other, or as a part of some other framework. To answer this question requires a little bit more digging into the background of the public order concept, as well as related applications. Let us first pause for another moment, however, on the observation that the distinction of the temporal and spiritual power and their relegation, however contested it was, to different political bodies began with the advent of the church. When we consider a situation in which the church, having previously required political cooperation of its baptized members in political office, that's the pink explanation of the old framework, releases them from that requirement, what sequence of events is likely to follow? One option, which we could call the historical reversion option, would suggest that the civil power would revert to the status quo ante prior to the advent of the church and simply assume to itself the spiritual power. In that case, the church's withdrawal of permission to act in spiritual causes could be understood not as the exclusive retention of spiritual jurisdiction by the church, but as the ceding of the field to the state. One difficulty with denying to the civil power any authority with regard to spiritual ends, then, is that the state tends towards spiritual ends insofar as it aims at the common good. In the Christian dispensation, God is, as Augustine and Aquinas put it, the common good of all. On this view, when the church withdrew its permission for the civil power to cooperate in spiritual causes, it traded too heavily on continued acceptance of ecclesiastical jurisdiction in principle by the state. The subsequent signing of concordats in the post-Vatican II era can be interpreted in this light. If the civil power simply accepted the restriction of its power on the basis of its spiritual power on the basis of public order, it would not be necessary for the Italian Republic to agree to guarantee the church its liberty of action as well as its proper jurisdiction. From the standpoint of the church, confident that it possesses something called ecclesiastical jurisdiction, even though it doesn't heavily discuss that in Dignitatis Humanae, it's easy to imagine that the civil power could be limited to respecting religious liberty on the basis of securing public order. But to obtain this result, internally to the civil power itself, the task is somewhat more complicated. An early effort at church-state distinctions, such as Locke's letter concerning toleration, for example, would have been incomplete without a definition of churches. He paired his view that the care of souls was no concern of the civil magistrate with a view that the care of souls was, in fact, essentially autonomous. A church, he said, I take to be a voluntary society of men, joining themselves together of their own accord in order to the public worshiping of God. For Dignitatis Humanae to play out according to plan, then, the civil power either has to accept the restriction of its cooperation in spiritual causes on the pink basis, on the basis, the civil power has to realize that the church is withdrawing its request, or it has to accept the restriction of its cooperation on some other basis, for example, the self-limiting adoption of liberalism. Once you have a concept of ecclesiastical jurisdiction and the action of that jurisdiction through baptism, it's easy to see that the action of the civil power with respect to public order is, in its own sphere, something different. Hence, Vermeersch, the canonist I quoted earlier, was able to describe it by distinguishing it from power exercised with regard to a spiritual end. But what about the view of this question from the other direction, from the standpoint of the civil power? Let us first consider the meaning of public order somewhat more deeply. In ecclesiastical context, public order does not have the narrow sense of public peace. It does not mean public peace or anything like it, or the avoidance of public disturbance. Rather, it refers specifically to, and it has the same meaning in civil law as well, to essential elements of the common good that are directly obtained by laws concerning the public order. So in canon law, this is actually a relatively recent concept in canon law, an intercanonistic discourse in order to explain the obligations of travelers, for example, traveling priests under canon law. Standard explanation, laws that protect the public order are those that are so necessary for the good of the community that when violated, the common good would be harmed. So, again, quoting from this standard commentary, laws that provide for public order in the church include those that affect the exercise of authority, such as judicial power, administrative offices, and parochial functions. So you see it's much broader than just, it's not a matter of public disturbance. Governing meetings, public events, and the public celebration of the liturgy, preventing offenses to the faith, and laws given specifically for travelers. The commentary continues, the public order should not be confused with uniformity of conduct. While an orderly and well-regulated community is desirable, every community may tolerate reasonable exceptions for travelers. The canonistic concept of public order thus came out of civil law discussions of the 18th and 19th century in the field of private international law or conflict of laws concerning the obligations of travelers. Laws of the public order, as one scholar, canonistic scholar, explains this, John Henry Hackett, are those that are absolutely indispensable to society as such, whose violation results in the destruction of the public order. They are laws that bind aliens and travelers, although they are not ordinarily subjects of a local law. For if he violates such a law, he inflicts harm upon the community just as if he were its member. Thus, in both the civil and ecclesiastical society, the notion of public order, continuing this quotation, has certain common characteristics. Its object is the public security. Laws that protect the public order are only those that have for their direct object the protection of a good that is indispensable to society as such. It can be seen here that the concept of public order then does not emerge from public law per se. It is not an aspect of the external government or arrangement of a society. Rather, the concept was created to answer in situations of private international law on what basis someone traveling in another jurisdiction is obliged to follow its laws. In an ecclesiastical context, then, public order refers to those laws which, because of their immediate impingement upon the common good itself, demand obedience, obviously from everyone within the jurisdiction, but even from a traveler not otherwise subject to the laws of a certain jurisdiction. Public order is thus a concept from private international law, but with applicability in each order, civil and ecclesiastical. The canon law has a concept of public order, and the civil law has a concept of public order as well. The fact that public order operates in the canon law brings us to an important point. Public order does not refer to the common law concept of public peace, and public order must be spoken of separately within the civil law and within the church. Here is the significance of this point. Within the canon law, public order includes a religious or spiritual aspect, given the spiritual ends or aims of the church. Thus, some laws that secure public order in the church are ones that govern, that specifically concern spiritual ends. For example, laws concerning fasting and abstinence. Traveling priests have to provide sufficient identification and proof of their faculties, since failure to do so would be clearly an abuse of public order. Even statutes regulating the orderly conduct of sacred processions and things like that are also aspects of public order. Public order, then, is not simply the concept of public peace, but concerns certain external matters of orderliness insofar as they provide essential conditions for the obtaining of the common good. In an ecclesiastical concept, those elements of public order have a spiritual element. It's my contention, then, that the concept of public order, when viewed in this way from the standpoint of the civil power, tends not toward necessarily toward the preservation of religious liberty, but in fact toward the infringement of ecclesiastical liberty. The reason for this tendency is that the civil power has its own conception of public order. Public order is a concept that operates within the civil power as well. But there has been a point at which public order in the civil sphere and public order in the ecclesiastical sphere have met before. And to see it, we simply have to think of the ecclesiastical and the civil order as orders with a proper jurisdiction. The line between them, the meeting of the civil public order and the ecclesiastical public order, has grown less visible. Indeed, it was its lack of visibility that made the formulation in Dignitatis Humanae possible. To see it, we simply need to look at an entirely commonplace, though hotly contested, area of jurisprudence in lands with both civil and ecclesiastical courts, namely a certain type of appeal called the appel comme d'abus, or appeal as from an abuse. The original idea of the appel comme d'abus was as a kind of jurisdictional checking mechanism. In cases of an invasion of the prerogatives of the civil power by an ecclesiastical court, a cleric whose case was being heard in ecclesiastical court could appeal to a civil judge with the hope of having the case returned to an ecclesiastical court for a better resolution, and likewise the reverse. By the 17th century, however, and particularly in France, such appeals had become so commonplace that they touched not only matters of real necessity, but all manner of ecclesiastical points. One example in particular will drive home the sometimes extraordinary manner in which these appeals worked. In 1568, Pope Pius V issued a standard version of the Roman Breviary to take precedence over all local liturgies, with a few exceptions, and controversies were swirling, particularly in France, which had numerous so-called Gallican liturgies of varying degrees of antiquity and authenticity, as well as a strong tradition of independence in liturgical matters. So even though that breviary was issued in 1568, it wasn't until 1599 and 1600 that the Bishop of Angers even tried to impose it. And he did so in 1599, tried to impose the Roman breviary in his diocese. There was only one little problem. A little collegiate church called the Church of the Trinity insisted on holding to its ancient breviary, the Breviary of Anjou, rejecting the new Roman breviary. And so, as things always tended to happen in these circumstances, and in a lovely illustration of the fact that the church, in order to kind of illuminate, give you a picture of what I have in mind, in referring to ecclesiastical jurisdiction, due to the resistance of the canons of this church, the bishop decided to throw them in jail. And so he jailed all of the clergy of the Collegiate Church of the Trinity for refusing to say the new Roman breviary into the diocesan jail, the bishop's personal jail. So it's an essential feature. A priest who had been jailed made an appel comme d'abus to the civil court in this case of obvious abuse. And in a decision which solidified what the Gallican Church, or what the Crown referred to as the Gallican liberties, with respect to its liturgical rites, in 1603, the French Advocate General Louis Servin gave a judgment, siding with the Gallican traditions, gave a judgment in Parliament against the imposition of the Roman breviary and ordered the earlier services to be maintained, ruling, quote, that nothing is to be innovated in the exercise and celebration of the divine office without royal authority, end quote. It wasn't long, however, that the Crown realized that the real source of disorder was, in fact, with the resisting clerics and with the resistance to the Roman breviary generally and not the adherence to it. And so in 1606, Henry IV approved a decree of a church council at Bordeaux imposing the Roman breviary there. So they just wanted public order. In 1611, the Parliament then cited that decision to impose the Roman breviary on the Collegiate Church of Saint-Maxime de Chinon, with the proviso, with a special exception given by the king, that the canons would be able to preserve their local cycle of saints. And in fact, in the immediate wake of the publication of the new Roman Missal, the French authorities took even more direct aim at the church's liturgical independence, requiring that all editions of the Roman Missal have the name of the king inscribed in the canon of the Mass. At the most fundamental level, then, the Crown had initially claimed authority over liturgical matters in the mechanism of the appeal on as from an abuse due to the discord which the introduction of the Roman breviary had caused. But within a few years, insistence on the traditional French diocesan liturgies also seemed to be a source of discord in light of the church's or the state's need for unity. In other words, issues of public order gave rise to the French Crown's claim to protect and therefore, in effect, govern the church in liturgical matters, at least on appeal. As the 19th century Jesuit canonist Dominique Bouix put it, Gallicans, even moderate Gallicans, hold that royal authority is absolutely independent in all those things which pertain to temporal concern. Some ordinance concerning the liturgy, independent in all those things, including some ordinance concerning the liturgy, inasmuch as it can stir up some people and excite disorders, and that touches on civil tranquility. Therefore, for all these reasons, the king will have the right of prohibiting lest something concerning the liturgy be established without his supreme authority. And for all of those reasons, end quote from Bouix. And for all those reasons, the power which preserves civil tranquility has certain authority in the external area of the liturgy. They saw the Gallican idea, saw the liturgy as simply an external matter of jurisdiction. Jacques d'Amel, a royal prosecutor in the ecclesiastical court of Rouen, in his 1612 essay, The Royal Policy or Political Regime Concerning Ecclesiastical Persons and Things, explained this principle as follows. Or the principle of civil courts hearing cases on appeal from ecclesiastical courts. He says, this is why whatever power and jurisdiction the prelates, bishops, and other ecclesiastics have, the emperors, kings of France, and other Christian princes would not have allowed them to make laws, constitutions, and ordinances as much for the order and discipline of the church as they do for ecclesiastical persons and things, and to exercise their sovereign power against those of the said order which disturbed the state and the public repose. The French crown's claim to hear appeals from ecclesiastical to civil courts, wrote a later Gallican writer, concerned, quote, and this is translating, not the purely spiritual discipline, so it's like, ooh, this doesn't concern any internal matters of the church, but the ecclesiastical discipline in its rapport with the policy concerning cults and the public order of the state. And this writer uses the ordre public, so the exact same term. In fact, the term from which the canonistic term is drawn. Appeals as from abuse were uniformly presented on the grounds of violation of public order or danger to public order. In 1769, the king's general prosecutor, the procureur general of the king, appealed directly to the Parliament of Grenoble, complaining that certain censures that had been imposed by the Archbishop of Vienna merited examination, quote, in relation to the objects of public order that are directly compromised. It's a perfect expression of how what public order means, and it meant a way, and so it operated in the civil sphere in a way that tended toward the invasion of ecclesiastical jurisdiction. Returning then to the Second Vatican Council's Declaration on Religious Liberty, we find the following phrase. This is a restatement of public order later in the document. Provided the just demands of public order are observed, religious communities rightfully claim freedom in order that they can honor the supreme being in public worship. That's a quote from the council. Although by the time of Vatican II there were liturgical variations due to the experimental efforts of the preconciliar liturgical movement, liturgical differences did not have an evidently political character. The decisions of the Sacred Congregation of Rites had not been contested by local political authorities for a long time. Bishops were not throwing anyone in jail in order to enforce liturgical changes. Anyway, the council's allowance of restrictions on public worship due to the just demands of public order might have tacitly permitted the old Gallican claim had the occasions for civil strife over the liturgy been present. Such interventions have occurred even recently. At the beginning of the July monarchy, which saw the Bourbon restoration ended in favor of the popular constitutional monarchy of Louis-Philippe d'Orléans, upon the overthrow of Charles X, Louis-Philippe required in the liturgy that the versicle Domine Salvum Fac Regem replace Charles's name with his own, Domine Salvum Fac Regem Ludovicum Philippum, and that command prompted the Benedictine Dom Geranger, in the second volume of his Institution Liturgique, to ask rhetorically whether some future democracy would abolish the 22nd Sunday after Pentecost, whose readings featured the injunction of Romans 13 to honor the king. In light of how the Appel Comme d'Abus usually worked, it's easy to see why the popes issued continual injunctions against them, against these appeals, in an annual Maundy Thursday ceremony given from the balcony of St. Peter's, pronouncing an excommunication reserved to the Holy See. It's called the Bull in Chaena Domini, on anyone who made an appeal from an ecclesiastical to a secular court, as well as those moving the avocation of spiritual causes from ecclesiastical to lay courts. The boundaries of civil and ecclesiastical jurisdiction were constantly contested. The church did not respond to invasions of its prerogative in setting liturgical exercise by appealing to religious liberty, but rather to the exclusive jurisdiction it had given the Sacred Congregation of Rites in 1588 to govern an external, formal matter such as the ecclesiastical liturgy. In a political world with two jurisdictions, one asserting jurisdiction over all spiritual causes, and the other asserting jurisdiction over temporal causes, but with persons subject to each jurisdiction in differing respects, the Appel Comme d'Abus linked the two through the concept of civil public order. Indeed, it showed the way that at least the external features of otherwise spiritual matters could be seen as an aspect of public order, and thus subject, despite ecclesiastical protestations, to civil jurisdiction. Now, of course, after the revolution in France and throughout the 19th century in Europe and the Americas, the church saw its jurisdiction steadily limited. The world of jurisdictionally integral nation-states had no place for papal fulminations against appels pom d'abus generally. The policy of the Holy See since Dignitatis Humanae contains one element which shows the obvious limitations of merely requiring the civil power to acknowledge religious liberty. I refer to concordats signed between the Holy See and civil powers, such as the modification of the Lateran Accords in 1984, which explicitly guarantee specific elements of ecclesiastical jurisdiction. The obvious assumption or presumption of such accords, or premise of such accords, is that while the key elements of Dignitatis Humanae do work in the direction of disestablishment, the mere insistence on religious liberty is insufficient to obtain protection of the church. As we pointed out earlier, however, public order is not something wholly separate from the common good. It refers to laws that directly pertain to essential conditions of the common good, the sine qua non of the common good, things without which the common good could not be obtained. The apparent neutrality of public order, then, is only, so to speak, a contextually emergent property of already secular societies and their citizens. The implementation of Dignitatis Humanae, Section 3, then, just talking about its implementation, not about its compatibility with the tradition, has little to do, of course, in most countries, with Christian officials suddenly feeling that the spiritual power no longer needed their sort of collaboration. The pink thesis has to do with reconciling the teaching, not to do with its implementation. Instead, the implementation, the reason that it's sort of worked thus far, has to do with the disappearance of contested jurisdiction in spiritual matters. So it only works if there's no contest or disagreement over the boundaries of ecclesiastical jurisdiction. The sufficiency of the concept of public order to limit civil interference in ecclesiastical matters is thus open to question, because it was precisely the thing that was used to intervene. In the olden days, public order itself provided the ground for transferring all manner of cases from ecclesiastical to civil courts. Only the solemn anathematization of that on the grounds of the church's independent jurisdiction was a remedy, and an ineffective one at that. But the present dispensation requires the civil power operating on its own to evaluate the conditions of its own public order. As its notion of the common good becomes more egalitarian in some respects and more libertarian in others, it begins to see external elements of religious practice as potentially threatening to essential preconditions of the common good, namely to public order. The movement from the common good to public order was intended to make a clearer basis for the liberty of the church, to be sure. But in practice, and especially in countries without concordance, we're headed back to the question that we sought to avoid. We have gone from a spiritually inflected common good to a supposedly neutral public order, accompanied by a difficulty in seeing the church as a separate jurisdiction. In that context, the question of the common good and whether and in what way religion is a part of it will again become controversial. And that, I think, is how we attempted to go from the common good to public order, but are continually drawn back. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that great talk. Is it correct to say that you believe that Dignitatis Humanae was the main target of it, is to educate the secular order on religious liberty? Because it seems to me that the first target is to educate ecclesiastics and integralist types, that in fact we need to understand something that's gone forward in history that was providential that maybe we haven't understood.
I think you're right. At somewhat early in the talk, I said that Dignitatis Humanae and the question of its implementation gives rise to two questions, namely, you know, what the effect of it is on the church, and you know whether it provides a sufficient rationale for you know members of the church itself, to withdraw from some of its earlier claims, and then second, whether the same concept is also sufficient to guard religious liberty. I mean, it's intended to do both of those things, and in itself. In itself, it is, you know, from the church's standpoint, its own public order is something that it wishes to secure. So, insofar as the church's own public order includes, the determination of who its ministers are, you know, what its liturgical rights are, etc., of course, the concept of public order is enough. The question is whether so, and then. So again, the two questions that it gives rise to are, is it enough to encourage the church to withdraw from some of its earlier claims? It obviously did that. Is the concept of public order enough to also secure the religious liberty of the church? That's the part that seems to be more open to question. And you could say then that the existence of some of the concordats, subsequent concordats, have to specify in great detail the boundaries of ecclesiastical jurisdiction, but there aren't concordats in all countries. So maybe, you know, I guess one suggestion that just came to mind is, as the civil power attempts to become more invasive, for example, in our own country, maybe it would require a specific concordat, you know, confirming the church's, you know, perpetual ability to determine its own ministers or something like that. But this week, at least, we seem to be going the other direction.
Thank you very much for your talk. My knowledge of church history is so slight as to feel that you may have doubled it in your brief remarks. And so I have to abstract a little bit from that, but that's just a more general question and just an idea that occurred to me in passing. I bristle a little bit at the term public order, which, although I see it as a ecclesiastical history, certently in recent or 20th century history, public order seems to be a favored objective of tyrannical governments. And it occurred to me, and this is a hypothesis which I hope to have corrected or qualified, that public order's appeal as a principle seems to be that it's minimal and therefore might ensure minimal religious liberties, or as minimal natural laws as basic observances, whereas the common good seems more maximal, I would even say infinite or absolute, especially in an ecclesiastical context. But I wonder if there isn't a possibility of looking at it in the opposite way, that the common good being very difficult to specify, especially when there is this division of sovereignty between religious and civil authorities, it's difficult to satisfy the public that one's actions are instilling the public good, and therefore there is always a necessity of persuasion and a sort of perhaps built-in moderation, since it's very difficult to proclaim that the common good has been upheld today. Whereas public order, because it seems like a minimal objective, and yet it too was never perfectly achievable, it seems to provide perhaps a kind of a pretext for an almost infinitely elastic degree of, especially civil, disorders of various kinds, one would judge whether to allow those disorders in light of the common good or not. As soon as the public order becomes the objective, it seems again, as I say, generally, that seems to be a wonderful tool of, again, as I say, intolerant civil authorities who are always provided with examples of disorder.
That's my argument.
That's your
argument. I mean, that's
great.
I think we're in agreement. I think exactly that. public order, you know, is a term that tends to slip by, because when you hear, okay, well, the state on the account of dignitas humanae isn't allowed to restrict religious liberty except on the basis of public order, you have in mind major public disturbances or a sect explicitly threatening the public peace or something like that. But in fact, yeah, its operation, I think, naturally tends to be, because of its subtlety, potentially broader in scope. And yeah, we could see that implemented in all sorts of ways. Particularly, I mean, if you think that elements of maybe some element of anti-discrimination law or something like that could be so important to, you know, securing the most basic features of an egalitarian society, that it could be the basis for civil intervention in some external matter of church governance.
Thank you, Dr. Cobham. In the last couple of years, I've read a couple of articles that claim to observe a change in rhetoric from freedom of religion to freedom of worship. Is that part of a similar kind of recognition of the conflict here that you're talking about in your judgment?
Could you elaborate a little bit on what you have in mind?
Well, instead of public officials talking about the blessings of freedom of religion, apparently, according to these articles, they're now talking about the blessings of freedom of worship. In particular, the article that I'm thinking about, I don't remember who the author was, but he was claiming that President Obama spoke almost exclusively in terms of freedom of worship. And the author thought that seemed like, in his judgment, a pernicious attempt to limit the freedom of Christians in the society to what goes on inside of the church building itself. It just seemed like,
yeah,
if he was right, there would be a sort of parallel here to what you're talking about, or maybe part of the same dynamic.
Yeah, no, I mean, if he's right, then, you know, Obama is probably the closest to a, you know, Francoist understanding of, like, the, you know, limited religious liberty for other sects. You know, because the, you know, freedom of worship in that sense is the most that non-Catholic sects were allowed in the Spanish Charter of 1945. So that's what I had in mind. So freedom of religion in that. So even under, in other words, even under a kind of classical or pre-Vatican II, you know, heavy notion of a religiously inflected state or a Catholic state, private worship was always permitted, and it's permitted in the Spanish Charter of 1945 as well. But the Spanish Charter of 1945 gave no authorization to external activities like, spreading literature or, you know, public ceremonies and things like that. So that is an interesting change. On my account, both liberty of religion and liberty of worship are kind of underdetermined concepts to what churches have claimed to be, namely some type of jurisdiction. And so I was trying to make the point that even Locke saw that. He saw that it wasn't enough just to say that the civil power has no competence in spiritual matters. You then have to specify what the entity is which has competence in spiritual matters and what the boundaries of that are. So speaking of the liberty of churches and trying to figure out what that means in terms of, you know, everything from elements of worship to selection of ministers, admission of members, etc., has to be further specified. It's interesting to see then, I'm not sure what to make of that. I'm not sure what to make of the, you know, claim to that article, whether it's true, and that it's no longer the, you know, President Obama's now a private citizen. So I'm not sure what exactly it means. But it is interesting to see how, shifts toward expressivist notions of what religion is, that freedom of worship is kind of something like freedom of speech or freedom of expression, could actually lead to a more... So if that is correct, and if that becomes the notion of what freedom of worship is, then you'll see even more clearly, or feel even more poignantly the effects of the absence of thinking of religion or churches as jurisdictional entities.
Thank you, Professor Patrick, for your excellent talk. I was hoping I could get your view on projects in the 20th century or 21st century which attempt to use public order to defend the church. I have in mind the sort of Marassian idea that is very French about Catholicism, at point just branches, give things back for the church. Are they kind of doomed by the tools that they have recourse to? Is there any hope? Or in that case, they're loved. But how far along that path can you go in defense of the church using tools that you're traditionally used to take from?
In the end, I have a very loose, or rather flexible, concept of what public order could entail, and so I don't see any natural limit to the good results of using public order to defend ecclesiastical institutions. It's just that when you speak of civil public order only, and without thinking of looking at the other side or the ecclesiastical side and having an answer to the question of what the other thing is, then you're putting all the weight on the exercisers of civil power to determine what the essential conditions of public order are. Therefore I wouldn't be critical of those efforts, but they all raise the question of what the other thing is.
Dr. Papin, if I can take the prerogative of the guy holding the microphone to ask a question, really just to get your reaction to another contemporary setting where this conflict of jurisdictions comes up. When you have cases of disciplining priests, so the church is going to discipline a priest that it judges to have acted inappropriately, and of course in the recent scandals there's been a lot of evidence of where the church has failed to discipline priests, or sometimes priests complain that when they do get disciplined that it's too severe or it's not following procedural norms, for example.
Yeah.
So they're just automatically removed from ministry before there's a canonical trial or something like that. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of in the circle of priests you have plenty of questions about how that works inside the church system. And in the U.S., after the 2002 Dallas Charter began to be implemented, that's dealing with claims of, credible allegations that a priest has abused someone. Some priests who were being disciplined appealed to the secular courts against their bishop. I mean, they would start a lawsuit. They would file a lawsuit in a civil court. And the church's response to that was, if you take that move, you are losing all of your rights in the canonical system. So basically, you do that at your peril. You can get a civil judgment if you can, but we're never going to give you what you're asking for from us, because this is an exclusively internal question. Your comment. Does that illustrate your argument, or is that a good way to do this?
Well, I'll tell you what I think it illustrates in a second, but what you describe, I believe that the loss of the loss of subsequent access to canonical trials in such cases has been the church's policy in the U.S. since the 1880s. The civil and ecclesiastical procedures surrounding appeals as from abuse was set in 1883 or something like that. So it has know, the phenomenon has been around. What I think this scenario illustrates is the difficulty, and maybe what appeals as from abuse illustrate, is the difficulty of specifying at what point ecclesiastical jurisdiction is insufficient. That seems to be the essential confusion surrounding ecclesiastical jurisdiction in abuse cases. The church exercises all sorts of jurisdiction over its clergy. It can reassign them, can remove them from public ministry. Now, at what point does the civil power decide that jurisdiction has been exercised in a way insufficient to the gravity of the problem? And so what's interesting to me are how the reactions to the abuse crisis have played out. There's a tendency on the one hand to say that the civil power should take over all investigation of pretty much everything that's happened internally with regard to church government for the last 50 years, something like that. On the other hand, the church no longer has and hasn't had for a long time what it previously had, namely total jurisdiction over its clergy, up to and including the ability to imprison them. The church exercises, some degree of jurisdiction over its clergy, but not at some kind of indeterminate point at which it, could pass over into being a civil matter or definitely passes over into being a criminal matter. There are two possible responses. One is, there should be no such thing as ecclesiastical jurisdiction over clergy in any matters like this, and the civil power should have a much stronger involvement in tracking those investigations and allegations at every point, such that at every point of the exercise of ecclesiastical jurisdiction, it's civilly inflected or maybe the civil power takes over. The other possibility, which is not discussed, is that the church returns to having total jurisdiction over its own clergy. In that circumstance, it would have to develop all the procedures necessary to, completely punish its wayward clergy. All I'm saying is there's a kind of danger in all gray area sovereignties like that, where the problem may not be that ecclesiastical jurisdiction is a bad idea, and that the problem may not be that the civil power has been insufficiently attentive. It may just be a phenomenon of having some forms of some forms of jurisdiction, but not all.
Give our thanks to Dr. Pappas.